much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Davis, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series on the Bible, mythology, the universe, and the Civil War, etc., that have sold over 4.7 million copies. A newly revised, updated, and expanded edition of Don't Know Much About History Anniversary Edition was recently released by HarperCollins. It now presents a complete survey of American history from before the arrival of Columbus in 1492 right through the events of the past decade from 9/11 through the election of Barack Obama in the first years of his administration. Dubbed the King of Knowing by Amazon.com, his latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. And he has an article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning. He also blogs at don'tknowmuch.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Davis.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And as they say in horse racing, they are entering the backstretch now.
That is true. And your latest book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. I mean, just following on from our previous conversation with Alec McGillis of the New Republic, we don't know a lot about this president who might be Mitt Romney. We don't know anything about his taxes. We don't know about anything about the people who've been giving him money. Is that unprecedented? Plus, he hasn't had hasn't spoken to the press for over 3 weeks. Is that unprecedented in American history to have a president who has managed to keep so much about who he is and what kind of money he has and who's giving him money from the American people?
Well, two things come to mind immediately from very, very distant historical precedents. First of all, when Alexander Hamilton was arguing for the Constitution and the presidency back 225 years ago in the Federalist Papers, he talked about the presidency and what it should have. And he said the president needed to have vigor. And by that, he meant energy, dispatch, and secrecy. So when you go back to the framers, they weren't even that much afraid of secrecy. In fact, the presidency was created in secret when we go to Philadelphia and the convention in 1787. But we've come a long way since then, obviously, and everything that's happened in history since then has been much more transparency than less, although the other interesting precedent that comes immediately to mind is the fact that many Americans did not know that Franklin D. Roosevelt was in a wheelchair when he was elected four times. There were only three photographs known that the FDR Library knows of showing Roosevelt in a wheelchair. So we have a history of keeping some things secret. Obviously, the secrets of some presidents and their private lives has been secret. But, you know, since the Watergate years, we've really gone to a much more openness, certainly when it comes to candidates and their finances. Certainly Mr. Romney's reluctance or refusal to introduce some of his tax returns is relatively unprecedented in recent times.
So, Kenneth Davis, your article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning, what you say here is that starting with George Washington's 1792 re-election, 19 incumbents have been returned to office while another 8 were either denied the nomination or chose not to run. 5 presidents died during their first term. That leaves 10 first-term presidents who lost their re-election bids. Just take us through those 10 to give a sense of where we stand today with the possible re-election of Barack Obama.
Absolutely. And first of all, I would say that one thing that certainly seems to suggest is incumbency is obviously a powerful thing. And we've witnessed that, I think, in the past a few days as we've seen the president responding to a crisis and Mr. Romney, you know, clearly pushed to the sidelines of the media and in some cases perhaps even mocked for his efforts. And so that's what the power of incumbency means. But if you go through those 10, and I list them each in the CNN.com piece I wrote, you can only really point to 4 where the economy economy was clearly the issue. You know the famous Bill Clinton saying, the war room saying, it's the economy, stupid. But it isn't always, if you look at history. The four I point to specifically, Martin Van Buren, the eighth president who was one of the first incumbents who lost office, really only because of the economy, the Panic of 1837, it was called, our version of a depression. It was long, it was deep, it lasted a long time. Most Americans don't realize that depressions were quite common in the 19th century. There were many of them. They called them panics back then as opposed to the depression. But Van Buren was mocked as Martin Van Ruin. He was castigated as being not interested in the average person, that he was a lavish spender and that he was a dandy. So there was an element of presenting him and depicting him as an elitist as well. So it's always been that part of the campaign as well. And then, of course, Herbert Hoover, done in clearly by the Great Depression, loses the election in a landslide to Franklin D. Roosevelt. More recently, Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush were clearly the victims of the economy. But even there, I think you have to say that there are other factors involved. Going back earlier time among those 10, I point to the first two presidents to serve as one-term presidents, with John Adams and John Quincy Adams. And again, there it's not a matter of there being a terrible economic crisis, but these were men who were able to be painted as by their opponents as out of touch, as elitist, as not man of the people idea. And so that part of politics has always played into the election of the incumbent. I think you also look on the other side when you have incumbents who have been elected in spite of a very bad economy. And again, Franklin D. Roosevelt is the first example there. When he was reelected in 1936, the economy was still what we would call a basket case in modern terms.
Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Davis, the author of the New York Times bestseller Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series on the Bible, mythology, the universe, and Civil War, etc. His latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, and he has an article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning, and he also blogs at don'tknowmuch.com. So this is clearly would be music to the Obama campaign's ears, given how much we have bought into the James Carville, Bill Clinton notion of it's the economy, stupid. What other factors do you think are at play in this particular election that have some echoes of history? Because, you know, in terms of a couple of the people that you mentioned, George H.W. Bush, you know, the role of Ross Perot there, William Howard Taft, the role of the Bull Moose candidate, who, of course, made himself a lame duck when he got reelected by saying he wouldn't run for a third term, and he tried to make up for it, Teddy Roosevelt. Obama's had a pretty easy run, hasn't he? He's had no primary challenges. There are no, I mean, the third party people, the Greens and the Libertarians, are polling at about 2% of the electorate. We could have another Florida situation if it gets too tight, but by and large, none of those factors have impacted Obama. So how do you assess him in terms of a presidential candidate? Has he been relatively lucky?
Well, I would say so, in the sense of some of those you mentioned. First of all, one of the most fascinating campaigns in American history 100 years ago, you referenced it, 1912, Taft versus Roosevelt versus Woodrow Wilson, and throw Eugene V. Debs in there for good measure. It was quite an extraordinary year. And this was the time at which Taft was the incumbent. He had been Roosevelt's successor. Roosevelt then went off to safari in Africa, came back and decided that Taft wasn't quite up to the job and decided to run again. Lost the nomination in the Republican convention, stormed out angrily, and started his own party, the Progressives or Bull Moose. He then went on to become the most successful third party candidate in history, but because he and Taft split the vote, it really helped Woodrow Wilson to victory. By the way, they said back in those days that Taft, T-A-F-T, meant take advice from Theodore. Not a happy thing to be able to have to run against the image of your predecessor. You mentioned also Ross Perot, and that's a crucial one in 1992, as well as Ralph Nader in 2000. And third-party candidates have always filled this role in American history, with the exception of Roosevelt. They've almost always been spoilers who never really had a chance themselves. And that goes back to the very early days of American history. So yes, Mr. Obama doesn't have, did not have a challenger from another wing of his party in the nomination process. He doesn't have a major third party candidate. Although there's always something fluky that can happen. Elections are very, very strange things until they play out completely. So, yes, absolutely, he's been lucky in that sense.
But surely, Kenneth Davis, one of the things that's changed over the years and will affect this race is the unprecedented amount of money pouring in. It's going to be a $6 billion election, and Citizens United's Supreme Court decision have opened the floodgates, clearly, and so much of the money is unattributed. In fact, we have a paradox where there's a lot of voter suppression going on, demanding registered voters and people who voted before to prove who they are. And conversely, people who are funding Mitt Romney in large part don't have to identify who they are. So maybe there are echoes of the first Gilded Age in this, but we have a totally different media environment today with so much different and new media that I'm wondering whether the whole process has been somewhat trivialized, with news becoming more like infotainment, and how much of the population nowadays see an election as a way that they see, for example, voting on Dancing with the Stars. You know, you're not necessarily voting for the leader of the free world. You're voting for whoever you happen to like at that moment.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that you've raised a whole host of really important issues that I think are on the table this year, Ian, especially with the Citizens United decision, and an awful lot of people on both sides are really concerned about this tremendous flood of money coming in, unrestricted, unregulated. Of course, those of us who remember Watergate and Richard Nixon, and that it all started with campaign slush funds and unregulated money, and that was the real true beginnings of the Federal Election Commission to begin to regulate that. But historically, it's always been part of the game. It's just that the stakes have gone up, as you said. But again, Theodore Roosevelt really complained about this back in 1912. He thought that the wealthiest of Americans were essentially buying the election. So it's always been a theme in presidential history, but it's really become so much more exaggerated because of television primarily and the great costs involved in television advertising. And it's interesting to see, for instance, about a week or so ago, I saw a piece that suggested that even members of the GOP who had in Congress, who had always resisted any calls for campaign finance reform, were getting scared by this because they were seeing that these nameless super PACs could now turn their sights on them. And so it's always going to come out of that sense of self-interest, I think, that makes some change. And clearly many, many people are upset with this. The fear I have, of course, is that this just turns off more voters. We already have a pretty pathetic record when it comes to not only presidential election involvement, but in the other years. And I think that this corrosive effect of all these big dollars and the advertising, which many, many people are really feel has gone way, way too far, might really be getting to a tipping point. So will we see some meaningful reform in this country? I'm not terribly optimistic about it, but I certainly hope so. Interesting small point, on the other hand, is that someone recently suggested that most of the money goes to the person who eventually wins. Now, in a sense that the money flows where the likely winner is going to be, not necessarily what they want to see. So that's an interesting aspect to this. I'm not sure it changes the basic debate, though.
Well, just in closing then, Kenneth Davis, you mentioned the wild cards, and of course the wild card in terms of Theodore Roosevelt was that he wasn't supposed to even be elected. He was the vice president. He put on there to balance the ticket against the choice of the plutocrats, and then lo and behold, McKinley gets shot, and the worst nightmare of the plutocrats ends up becoming the president. So any wild cards in this election?
Well, there are always the talk of the October surprise. I think we've had a small but significant one here today on the East Coast in Mayor Bloomberg issuing a very surprising 11th hour endorsement of Barack Obama on the pages of the Bloomberg newspaper. Of course, Mayor Bloomberg, mayor of New York City, and he's really tipping that decision to the question of climate change, which neither candidate had been addressing at all. So an issue that had not been on the table at all through almost all of this campaign is suddenly a fairly significant one when it comes to the endorsement of Mayor Bloomberg, which was highly sought by both candidates. So there are always surprises, and we don't know, for instance, what this storm is going to mean in terms of the final result. I'm sure it will have some impact. Maybe you're not feeling it on the West Coast, but here in the East, it's kind of all we're thinking about.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kenneth Davis.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's a great pleasure to be with you, and thanks for having me.
Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Davis, the author of the New York Times bestseller Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series on the Bible, mythology, the universe, the Civil War, etc., that have sold over 4.7 million copies. He has been dubbed the King of Knowing by Amazon.com, and his latest book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, and he has an article at CNN, Economy Not Key to Incumbent Winning. He blogs at don'tknowmuch.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about not just how much global warming is affecting New York and New Jersey, but how it's changing the geopolitics of the Earth.